Welcome back to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Abandon all hope, ye who enter here?
Also joining us this week is Charm City's very own Skiz Sizzik.
Glad to be back. It's been too long.
Despite what you may think, this week we're not talking about Dilbert, but Richard Elfman's 1982 film, The Forbidden Zone. I'm going to paraphrase something that Skiz wrote for Cashews to Cinemart 13 when I described the movie as a live-action animation hybrid full of sex, nudity, creative set design, wild musical numbers, and outlandish stereotypes. Richard Elfman's brother Danny provided a lot of music for the film, along with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. The soundtrack also combines old records from Cab Calloway, Miguelito Valdez, Josephine Baker, etc. And then there's the cast, but we'll get to that shortly. The movie is about the Hercules family. There's kid brother Flash, sister Frenchie, mom, pop, and gramps. They're living above a portal to the sixth dimension, a bizarre land ruled by King Fausto and Queen Doris, along with the little princess and their half-man, half-frog servant, Bustrod. That really just kind of scratches the surface of this wonderfully complex and jaw-droppingly outrageous film.
So, Michael, why did you pick Forbidden Zone this week?
Well, I'm a big fan of this film, and I have been since the first time that I saw it. I don't think that there's anything really out there quite like this. I really have to say that this was one of those films where whenever I would find somebody that liked it, it was kind of like an instant kinship kind of thing. And so this is one of the first movies that I think that Skiz, you and I talked about, where it was like, hey, you know, I'm a big fan of The Forbidden Zone. And then it was kind of like, okay, this guy's really cool. That was me thinking that about you, because you would never think that about me. So just wanted to put that out there. Anyway, Skiz, you are a big fan of this film, and you've talked to the director, Richard Elfman, about this before. I was hoping you can give us a little bit of background on where this movie comes from and how this came to be.
Well, I guess it all starts with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, which, for those of you that don't know, before Oingo Boingo was this groundbreaking new wave band, they were sort of a theater performance troupe that everything they did was either based on very, very old culture or contemporary, extremely avant-garde culture. And they did all sorts of crazy live shows. And Richard Elfman decided that, you know, before they all got old and the band fizzled apart, that he wanted to kind of document what they were doing by making a film based on what they were doing. And he started to make a 1-hour, 16-millimeter film called The Hercules Family, which he never finished because I guess it was going so well that people said, hey, you should abandon this and remake it in 35 millimeter and make it even better because you've already got the start of something great. And so that's what he did. He made Forbidden Zone. Most of the cast worked for free because they were all friends. Most of the budget went into animation and music rights. And then it came out and became obscure the second it came out, it seems.
Instantly obscure.
Well, it's because he was lambasted. He was criticized and, you know, picked on for those quote-unquote stereotypes because he's a huge Gollywog fan.
I don't know what Gollywog means.
Look it up, baby. First off, I see the film as this, you know, ultimate, it's the Ma and Pa Kettle movie that never got made. Or it's the Ma and Pa Kettle movie that...
Ma and Pa Kettle go to hell, basically.
Ma and Pa Kettle go to hell. There's also this, you know, interesting homage to the 1941 film Hell's a Poppin' as well, in terms of the humor. And a lot of the sets, you know, look, in the sixth dimension, look a lot of like the sets in Hell and Hell's a Poppin'. So you can see they're definitely influenced not just by Max Fleischer cartoons, but there's also a huge influence of 20s and 30s musicals there as well. So, you know, and there's that great sequence at the end that's just like this homage to Busby Berkeley. In terms of the cast, I'm a huge fan of Susan Terrell. Huge fan. You know, I love that she's got double, she's got two roles in the film. And the thing that always blows my mind is you got a cameo by Joe Spinelli in there, you know, which is amazing. You got the guy, you know, the guy who's in Lustig's Maniac, you know, he's in The Godfather, he's in Rocky with Stallone's best friend, and he pops up with this amazing little cameo, you know, with the word loved on his fist. And so, I mean, the cast is amazing. It's, you don't even recognize them until you actually take the time to look at the credits. You see Viva in there, and, you know, you see Hervé and Joe Spinelli, Danny Elfman in a dual role, Matthew Bright. It's a great cast. It's probably one of the most interesting movies you'll ever get the opportunity to experience. It's so out there, and, you know, it's not something you watch for the story. It's something you watch for the wow factor. It's like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm watching this bizarre movie. It's genius.
The Kipper kids, who... I imagine Forbidden Zone was probably most people's introduction to the Kipper kids. They are cult celebrities, if there ever were cult celebrities. And thanks to Forbidden Zone, I've become a huge fan of them. And I have to say, I don't think I knew who they were before I saw Forbidden Zone. But now I love the Kipper kids.
You got to wonder, too, if Forbidden Zone, in terms of directly about the Kipper kids, the fact that I wonder if Corey McCabe was influenced by Forbidden Zone in terms of making American Astronaut. You know, because you've got some elements there that are very similar, you know, the Kipper kids, and then I'm instantly reminded of that sequence in the bathroom in American Astronaut, you know, where they're singing Hey Boy. Very similar.
Now, Skiz, what's the story with the Kipper kids anyway? Because isn't one of them married to Bette Midler?
Yes, or at least was. I assume they still are. I haven't really kept up with them. But the Kipper kids were these two guys that I guess it was mid-70s, late-70s, they started turning up at performance art happenings. I'm actually not really sure where they're from. I assume they're from San Francisco, but there's something very LA about them, and I've seen videos of them performing in New York from like the late 70s, so I don't really know where they were based out of. But it was just these two guys. A lot of their shtick didn't involve any actual words, but just a lot of crazy grunting and sound effects. And their act was very messy. Lots of shaving cream, flour, and firecrackers, and you name it, messy foodstuffs. And it was just brilliant silliness. Yeah, I mean, they're so perfectly cast in this film. They're not really doing their act except for the crazy sound effects and gruntings and noises and stuff, but they're just, they have these great faces, just these smiles that you know, like they're live action cartoon characters.
For some reason, I always associate them, and I don't know why, but with Australia. I don't know what it is.
I think they had that HBO special that was supposed to tell their story. And it's been years since I've seen it, but I want to say it was part of it was shot in Australia. Like their characters as kids come from a foreign country, which in my head, I'm thinking Australia too. So maybe that was it, but I'd have to rewatch that special and, you know, don't quote me on it. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
There's such a strange addition to the movie, but yeah, they do fit in perfectly. I don't know what it is, but now thinking back on so many of the movies that I've picked for the show, but it's another frickin' musical.
Oh, bum bim bam bum, es el nuevo compás que los negros van bailando en la comparsa.
We've got some original songs in here. We've got some older songs. You know, I love that the way that they work in the older songs, and sometimes they'll add to the older songs. Sometimes they'll just kind of use them for what they were. I mean, because my other favorite song, I think, is Pico and Sepulveda, which I never realized was a real song. I don't know what it was, but when I was younger watching this movie, I didn't realize that these weren't all original songs for the film, which is really silly. You know, I love Mr. Hercules. I mean, he's barely in the movie, but he's probably one of my favorites, especially when he gets really mad at Frenchie and he just keeps doing that. You don't ever.
Going back earlier to what I was talking about in terms of being inspired, you know, by 30s musicals, you can see that. It's very evident because you can see if you look, just for example, you know, the way Elfman, he tends to shoot his actors. He's shooting the actors up above the sixth dimension. He's shooting them very distinctly in terms of how they shot, tend to shoot actors in the 30s and 40s in films. Like, you know, in terms of framing, you can see, like, he's doing a constant medium shot, and he's never on center. He's always off to the right a little bit, and he's just a little right and lower to the eye line. And it's very traditional. It reminds you a lot of 30s and 40s films and how they used to film and shoot actors like that. And also, you know, there's that great the Pa Hercules sequence where he's driving in his car, you know, down the road, and he's those great shots of him popping up into frame in front of the signs, you know, that's very traditional of 30s musicals. You see that all the time when you watch those old musicals like that.
And I love the guy who's dancing in that down the street and everything. And I love the guy in the classroom scene when they're that classroom scene is absolutely amazing. The classroom scene, I think, is the first scene I ever saw, which is such a weird sentence to say. I was flipping around on cable one night, and it was on the Max Headroom hosted cable show that was on the movie channel. I was just like, what the heck is this thing? I mean, there's Matthew Bright as Toshiro Bologna acting like a chicken, a very fey chicken. And then there's, you know, the very obvious man dressed as a woman as the teacher. And then there are all these pimps and just hanging out in the back of the classroom. It made absolutely no sense. And then they break out into song. They start doing the alphabet song and they, you know, start adding more to it. And I guess that's another connection to the American Astronaut, is there's kind of a play off of the old alphabet song in that as well.
That's a Three Stooges ripoff too. Right.
I don't know if the Three Stooges, if they were the originators of that one or not, but yeah. But anyway, yeah. And then at the end of the song, it just kind of goes into this more modernist music. And there's a huge dance sequence where one of the pimps gets up and just starts dancing across all these desks and stuff, and, you know, starts flirting with the teacher a little bit. But yeah, that was just amazing.
Squeeze it!
Johnny just shot Billy.
Johnny!
Well, the man was cheating, so I just had to do away with him, and that's all there was to it.
That does it, Johnny! You're going to Mr. Yodelbean's office!
You ain't taking me nowhere, you honky bitch!
A is A, 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 E, Icky, O, 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 Icky, A, E, I, O, O, Icky, I, O, O.
In the classroom sequences also are similar to the 30s musicals in the way the collection of the cast is very traditional, in the sense that you see, you know, as surreal as it is, the girls are typical pigtails like you would see in, you know, old movies. And
even though the girls are the Kipper kids.
You know, every ethnicity is represented in the classroom as well.
So, yeah, and then there's, like, the weird, like, how it's the Hercules family is very, very Jewish. And Gramps is, like, far younger than Flash, the younger brother, who is played by, I mean, this guy's got to be in his, like, 60s or something. And just really, like, borscht belt kind of accent and stuff. I don't know, like, Frenchie kind of comes out of nowhere. The French daughter. I don't understand where she comes from, but that was
That's called casting your wife.
Something about this movie doesn't make sense.
What could this be? I don't understand.
It's funny because I never think that when I watch it.
Really, it just makes perfectly logical sense.
You have to get over, like, it's one of those examples where you throw out suspension of disbelief and you just are able to forgive everything. Like, yeah, they're jumping through paper windows and glass breaking effects are going on. The machine guns are going off, but there's no fire from them. Or it is sporadic at times. So you totally forget all that stuff as not even being valid or realistic. And just go with the feeling of it, which is a surreal attack on your senses. And it's great. You can't go wrong with it. You know, it's good stuff. And then, you know, on the same note, we should be talking about the animation in the film, too, which is just phenomenal.
Yeah, I love the animation to this thing. And I think other than the classroom scene, one of the things that caught my eye was the whole entrance to the sixth dimension. And especially when Squeeze It, like, flies down through the intestines down into the sixth dimension. And I love those sets. I love, especially when they land, every time they land in the sixth dimension, the basement there, it just, like, the different paintings and, you know, drawings and different cutouts they have for the doors and stuff.
There's more pillows, too. There's more chocolate pillows every time someone comes down the tunnel.
So this week we spoke to Richard Elfman about the Forbidden Zone. Here's what he had to say. I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about what your involvement was with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo and really how this whole thing got started way back when.
God, in a nutshell, I was in a French theater company called the Grand Magic Circus. Frenchie was the lead, and when Danny got out of high school, he joined us for a summer touring, although he went on to spend a year in Africa after that. This kind of... not the same as the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, but it kind of like got my head going. You know, so I decided after a certain point that I wanted my own group, so I grabbed Frenchie, who was the lead of the Magic Circus, came back, founded the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, which was a bit more theatrical. It had 12 to 14 members. Then Danny came back from Africa, became the musical director. And then, I think it was about 5 years later or whatever, the group was kind of morphing into more of a rock band, and I wanted to preserve on film what I'd been doing on stage with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. And that's really what Forbidden Zone is, pretty much mostly my stage show.
And what kind of time frame are we talking here?
God, I probably started the Hercules family around 78 or 79. I shot it in 16 millimeter, and then some friends convinced me, well, why don't you add 20 minutes? And then someone convinced me, we'll shoot the other 20 minutes and 35, we'll blow up the 16, and we'll have more of a feature. But it did match, and a lot of the characters I had in the 16 millimeter film were just crazies off the streets. But the trouble with crazies off the streets is they're really crazy. You know, so they weren't reliable. You know, so then I cast it with at least some professional actors as well, although I still had my non-actors like the princess, etc.
I was curious to see, you know, in terms of Forbidden Zone, it's been compared at times to, like, you know, has to having the zaniness of those old, like, Olin Johnson films from the 40s, like Hell's a Poppin' and Crazy House. So I was wondering if films like that, you know, something cinematic, like past cartoons, were any kind of influence on you.
Well, more the immediate influence was like Robert Crumb, you know, going through the intestines and going through the throat, you know, complete homage to R. Crumb. And then I'd say the earlier stuff was more Max Fleischer from the 20s and the 30s rather than the stuff from the 40s, you know, along with Pabst, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, German Expressionism.
And there's some hints of Berkeley in there too, right?
Yeah, a little bit, although I didn't do anything on his scale.
You know, what do you find so appealing with that era? I guess, is that a direct correlation with your plans to have the concept of colorizing the film and being a fan of that time period?
I wasn't after a particular time period. What we had with the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, we reprised stuff from the past that you couldn't presently get, but was classic, you know, that you should. You know, Josephine Baker, Cab Calloway, Yiddish vaudeville, Latin classics. And then Danny did completely avant-garde crazy stuff, and my rule with the Mystic Knights was nothing contemporary. So even in Forbidden Zone, like, I'm trying to think, there's Yiddish theater from 1918, Pico and Sepulveda's from the late 40s, Josephine Baker, Cab Calloway, those were early 30s. You know, so right there we spanned, say, 1915 to 1949. You know, so it wasn't so much a particular era.
You know, you do have a ton of older music in this film. When were you exposed to some of these great classics?
Well, I'm trying to think. I grew up in Crenshaw, so rhythm and blues, and then in the house was classical music. Neither Danny and I were into rock. And then I got into Latin music when I was about 15. And then the rest of it wasn't until, it was like I left college after a year, and I'm living in Berkeley and San Francisco. And then I started watching some Max Fleischer films, and there I'm exposed to Cab Calloway. When I went to Paris a few years later, there's Josephine Baker. And some of the other stuff, it was just in the Mystic Nights, I'd go through like hundreds of tunes to find like melodies to do for us. You know, I'm always looking for something that's timeless and catchy. The key to the longevity of Forbidden Zone is I've got to say that I've got timeless music in it. So even though the music's of a particular era, it transcends the era because it's really catchy. I have a thing I call it serviceable music and memorable music. But when I saw Chicago for the first time, I loved the stage play. And by the time I got to the parking lot, I couldn't really hum any of the melodies other than the lyric thing, all that jazz, because it's basically a bunch of cliches expertly put together, but it works to propel the show. Whereas memorable music, you hear it once and you take it for life. And that's what I look for in Forbidden Zone and what you're going to see in Forbidden Zone 2. The older or the ethnic or the odd pieces are going to be memorable music. What I intended to do originally was to have the negative ship to China and do a hand tinting process of all the Forbidden Zone sequences. It was like this arty thing that they did in Paris in the 20s before there was color film, but that was like way too impractical. You know, I was bankrupt long before I got to do that. So it was just the last couple of years that we got to colorize it. I had a generous offer from Legend Films, and they really let me tweak the hell out of it. You know, and I didn't even stick with the colors that people actually wore on set. We got to choose anything we want. I remember when we were colorizing it, I had to call Danny's wife, Bridget Fonda, to find out, like, what color eyes does Danny have? They let me tweak to my heart's content. I can't even watch the black and white version anymore.
Kind of feel that way, too, a little bit, actually.
Yeah, the color, the sets really come alive in the color version.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite comments was, who knew that Frenchie's bathrobe was yellow?
Yeah, which it wasn't. It was a dull mouse color. And, you know, we're just sitting around, you know, like, hey, you know, that's kind of drab. Hey, give me bright yellow. What does that look like? Bang. Okay, yeah, stick with that. You know, so you know, we got to tweak and tweak.
I was wondering, there's a lot of crossover between Forbidden Zone and Martin Brest's Hot Tomorrow. So I was wondering if there's any kind of connection other than just the actors there.
Well, yeah, the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo appeared in Hot Tomorrows. I'm the bass player on the stage in that film. Marty was a fan of the Mystic Knights and asked my brother, you know, hey, can we help with your, you know, little student film? Yeah, but we did one of the numbers. I mean, we were doing the songs we played were right from our Mystic Knights show. It's like he took the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo and we appeared in his little featurette.
So is that where you guys kind of got hooked up with Hervé Vilches, or was that another time?
No, we never even met him because we didn't film on the same days. It was like, really, we just showed up for 1 or 2 days shooting, and that was our involvement, like the nightclub things. Matthew, well, in the film, he's Toshiro Baloney, but in real life, he's Matthew Bright, writer, director. He wrote Gun Crazy, which broke Drew Barrymore as an adult, and then he wrote and directed Freeway, which broke Reese Witherspoon as an adult. But he and Hervé were roommates, and Hervé was screwing Susan Terrell, and that's how it all started.
It's put so poetically.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I've kind of been interested to ask you is, was the title Forbidden Zone, was that like the destined intention to title the film? And also, is there any kind of homage to Planet of the Apes, or is that just coincidental?
Totally coincidental. I'm trying to think. I was just Hercules, who's no longer really the Hercules family. There was much, you know, now I've got a real king and queen, you know, so there was much more stuff going on underneath. So I just kind of pulled that out of my head.
Nice. And then I'm a huge fan of Joe Spinell, so I have to ask how he got involved in the film. And then, you know, working with him, does he ever take the time to ask you guys, like, what the heck are you doing here? Like, what is the scope of this project?
I'm trying to think. Matthew found him, I think, through his acting teacher or something like that. And I just thought he was the perfect. The guy plays a good greaseball. You probably remember him in Godfather. You know,
yeah.
Button Man.
And Rocky, yeah.
Yes. So what was the thing? He asked me, could I keep the sailor suit? So that was like one piece of direction I gave him. And then I just said, I just said, really push it, Joe. You know, really, the thing with, you know, the scene with, like, Squeeze Its Dad is, along with the absurdity, there's genuine poignancy. Matthew's actually a good actor. You know, when he goes, like, Dad, it's kind of sad.
I love how he's got the words love on his fist, too.
Yeah, that was my idea at the last, he had love and hate, but he only hit him with one hand, so we didn't see. But, Joe is great to work with, and he immediately understood the part. You know, this is the abusive sailor screwing the mother, beating up the kid.
Oh, you're gonna see your son in a minute. He just turned 11.
The freak are you talking about? Me, a kid, Ruthie, come on.
Oh, you're the one, okay, you big gorilla. You want to see him, huh?
Yeah.
You want to see Chicken Boy? Come on. Oh, Chicken Boy!
That's really rich! Mom!
Squeeze it, meet your pop!
Dad? Thank you, Dad. Unless we have chickens in the family. Come here, baby.
Oh, yes. What are you doing, you big lump? Oh, I'm squeezing to help your mom!
Let go, my mother! Hey.
I love you. Shut up.
You're too much, baby. Come on, sugar. I got a heart on that won't wait. Ooh. And the ship leaves in a couple of hours.
What do you mean a couple of hours?
Oh, that's a sailor's life, baby.
I love you. Mom.
In the original draft of that scene, Matthew wrote the first draft, the sailor beats up the kid for like 3 minutes straight, just wiping the walls with him until he's a bloody pulp. But I had to cut the scene just to keep the pace going.
I was curious how you got involved with the Kipper kids, because they are so just amazing in this film.
Well, that was independent. They had come, we were living in Venice, and I was an early supporter of theirs, and I actually produced a couple fundraisers for them. And then one summer with the Mystic Knights, we had a club in Beverly Hills, and I had them do a number, kind of like during intermission, stark naked in a club in Beverly Hills. And you know, it's really shocking, the princess was in the show, too. But so I had been working with them for a couple of years before Forbidden Zone.
And I have a feeling they had no problem with the nudity.
Yeah. Well, I put them in jock straps like that was, you know, but they performed butt naked. And one of them is a German aristocrat, Martin von Hasselberg, who's been married to Bette Midler forever.
Is this whole, like, avant-garde circle of the time, is that how you became connected with Viva, too? Is that how she got involved in the movie?
God, where did Viva come from? I forgot how we found her. So she had no connection. She had, I don't know, someone just knew her. And, you know, we called her up, hey, do you want to be the ex-queen? You get to write your own scene. And she said, sure. Although she was a bit, you know, she has an acid tongue and an acid wit. And Susan was a little self-conscious about her weight at the time. Although I think, you know, she's absolutely beautiful, but she was fleshy. And so things are shot out of sequence. So we actually filmed their death before the fight. And what happened in the death is Susan is laying on top of Viva, and Viva's like yelling to me, oh God, she's so heavy, she's breaking my ribs, hurry up and get the shot. And you can just see Susan seething. And so the next day when we shot the fight, Susan beat the shit out of Viva, you know, like where her nails were broken off on her neck and was bloody, and I had to break it up. But we had some good action. I waited a while before I said cut. It was another behind the scenes.
Is there any truth to, I mean, obviously it's floating around, you know, that there was tension on the set between Hervé and Susan because they had dated and they were quarreling some. So has that been blown out of proportion in terms of what's been written about the film?
They mostly loved each other, except they had some terrific fights. And the fights were kind of like tragic comic because she came from the New York stage from the Lincoln Repertory Company. So she had this bellowing voice when she needed it. And Hervé, although he was a charismatic man, had a little voice box. So in the distance, you only heard her voice. And it wasn't until you walked closer that you heard that there was like an argument going on. You know, but they loved each other and, you know, it worked out, and whatever sexual tension or dramatic tension they had between them worked well for the characters.
You just got to wonder if he was hung.
I'm not going to repeat her descriptions of their lovemaking, which we heard often on the set. Yeah. Susan likes to shock. She likes to shock.
Can you tell me a little bit about Hyman Diamond? For some reason, I don't think that's his real name.
No, he was our realtor. I don't know why I had him be the wrestler, but, he was Gramps, but he was just our realtor. I'm not even sure if I should say his real name.
Yeah, he had like a whole backstory about being a wrestler and stuff. And isn't there a deleted scene with him kind of singing about that?
Yeah. The scene he was singing was something that I used to sing in the original Mystic Knights from Yiddish theater called Geiter Beiter Itzik.
And then what is the story with Flash as well? I've always wondered where you found him.
Okay, there were two. The original Flash from the Hercules family was like this. The guy was, I think, in his mid-50s, but he seemed like a hyperactive 12-year-old. And so he was just really good in the Boy Scout costume. But then he was another one that he had problems showing up on time or doing lines and would have upsets and whatever. And then at a certain point, he walked like 2 days into the Forbidden Zone. He had been in the Hercules family, but 2 days into the Forbidden Zone, he walked. And there was this old kind of washed-up Jewish comic who had like this little windowless office at the corner of the soundstage, like a rat's nest or something. And he looked vaguely like the original guy. And so I hired him to replace the original guy. The original guy, you could still see him in a few crowd scenes, but you can't tell the difference. You know, all the close-ups were with the replacement. I'm trying to think, he might have even been at the end of vaudeville, but he was just like this not working Jewish comic with all these film ideas.
He always seemed like he was like the essence of the Borscht Belt.
No, exactly. You nailed it. He was right. He was a Borscht Belt comedian in the 50s. Yeah, but he played a good 12-year-old, I thought.
One thing that a lot of people don't mention is the fact that The Forbidden Zone was shot by Gregory Sander, and I think it was his last film. So how did you get hooked up with him? Because this is a guy that worked a ton with Monty Hellman.
I'm shooting black and white, so I wanted a guy that really knew how to shoot black and white. But people don't realize, because the sets are just 12 rolls of seamless paper, you know, so nothing was spent on the sets. But I had a really top cinematographer. That paid off recently when we did the colorization, because the negative is so rich with a full gradation of the grayscale that we were able to really colorize to our heart's content. You know, this guy knew how to light and how to shoot.
What was the reception like when this film came out? I've always been curious if there was any kind of flack for, you know, the minstrel stuff or some of the Jewish stuff.
Well, when it came out, there was the condemnation by the politically correct, the arson threats. I was actually in a theater where we were cleared out by the fire department. We were kicked off the University of Wisconsin. Political correctness is, you know, if you took censorship a century earlier, political correctness was the censorship of the late 20th century and even right now. I mean, I don't have a racist cell in me. As a matter of fact, I was attacked because of the Jewish money changer, and it was my grandfather, and he wasn't acting. That's how the guy is. He's such a stereotype. You know, well, that's my fucking grandfather, and that's how he acts, you know. Oy vey, oy, you know. I mean, things have toned down a bit. You know, we were last year, they flew me to New York for the Museum of Contemporary Art, played Forbidden Zone, and had a line around the block, so I guess we're okay with the politically correct now. You know, the times have relaxed a little bit.
I wanted to ask you, too, since this was your first feature film, you know, and Forbidden Zone gets nominated for a Saturn Award, too, right? So what do you take from that? What do you learn from that film as a director that you translate onto other features that you've done down the road?
Well, Forbidden Zone was a little bit different because it was utterly uncommercial. I had no thought or plan of what I was going to do, really. I really just wanted to capture my stage show. I've done a couple other low-budget features, actually both from scripts of Matthew Bright, Shrunken Heads, and Modern Vampires. And then I've been doing some documentaries and TV work. But Forbidden Zone 2 is going to have it's kind of like a zany, absurdist spirit to it, you know, where I don't care who I offend. But it'll still have the core of a bunch of memorable music numbers. We're actually going to be doing part of the film in Ghana.
There's such a marked difference between Forbidden Zone and some of your later fare, and I'm curious if that's because you had years of practicing and perfecting and making the bits that eventually got strung together for the Forbidden Zone versus, I'm sure you didn't have that much time when they finally said go on like Shrunken Heads or something.
Oh yeah, like you're 16 days, go.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And Modern Vampire, like 17 days.
Yeah. Right. Because, I mean, there had been years for Forbidden Zone, and then I'm curious how much preparation is going into Forbidden Zone 2.
Forbidden Zone 2 is like, I've got pretty much the outline and half the script. Matthew's going to contribute a bit. My brother's written some great music for it, and I'm just finishing the selection of the tunes. And we've got this great Duke Ellington piece, Caravan, that opens it up. And it opens up in the Dust Bowl. There's just like a bunch of dust on the screen. And then you see this cheesy carnival and this kind of alcoholic, abusive, racist carnival geek. Paw, you know, this is all the opening number. The carnival blows over. He grabs his family. The shack blows over. They're in a jalopy. And there's Ma and Pa Kettle, you know, his wife's a corn pipe smoking inbred. And they have two kids, Stinky and Petunia. Stinky is a little like Flash, like a 12-year-old played by a 50-year-old. And Petunia is a tall, fleshy, lumbering slut, 13, but hopefully played by an older actress. So they drive across country to Crenshaw, but I'm going to shoot Crenshaw is going to look like Harlem in 1915, and I'm going to shoot Crenshaw in Ghana with the National Ballet Company to get the moves right, like all the characters on the streets and in the saloons and stuff. I've got the whole thing choreographed in my mind. But anyway, so Ma and Pa Kettle buy a house in Crenshaw that's connected to the sixth dimension, but they don't know it. And then there's the love affair between Petunia and Pythagoras Jones, and he's this poor, bespeckled black kid who's an inventor, and his mom's a crack whore, and he falls in love with Petunia, and Petunia's father is the racist carnival geek who's very violent. And you know, we've got a king and queen in the underworld. Stinky gets in trouble in class when he takes his dick out. He's sent to the school shrink, and they try to shock his testicles, and he strangles the nurse. And then police chase him down into the forbidden zone. We're going to go to Ghana for a week, and we'll dub the voices, but I'm going to have, like, all the like everyone in the saloon, like on a dime, could do a dance turn and a flip in the air and go right back to the pool and the dice game is kind of what I'm looking for. But the love scenes with Stinky and Petunia are going to be very tender, you know, like Eric Satie-type music. He speaks like Porgy from Porgy and Bess, but he's a complete scientific genius, like his show and tell. You know, he's got like a perpetual motion machine and another one that creates selectivity and another thing that levitates, and the gang guys just shout him down because he's a little jerk, you know, while he's doing his show and tell. But it's like Petunia talks a little like Betty Boop, and he talks like, "Oh, Petunia, dear honey, I love you so much," you know, kind of like, you know, and then Ma and Pa Hercules are kind of like reprobates from the Dust Bowl. And the king, I might have a big, heavy-set actor and shrink him down electronically to be the midget. They did a live stage show of Forbidden Zone. I just gave it my blessing. I wasn't involved, but they had a great little person playing the king. So he's someone I'm going to talk to. I don't know if he can sing, though. I'll probably have Susan Terrell and Matthew locked up in the basement and make them do a love scene.
Have you took this to Disney yet?
Well, they didn't go for the Mickey Mouse series. It almost stopped the film from being released.
Wow.
Yeah, no, we haven't taken it to Disney.
The young man, Mr. Jones, is he distant relative of Huckleberry P. Jones?
Maybe he could be. I mean, the mother's a crack whore and the father's an abusive pimp. Maybe that could be Huckleberry Jones. Okay, you just gave me an idea to tie it together, because his father and Petunia's father, the clown, the circus geek, they have a death fight. But eventually those dead babies start marching and you forget about all that stuff. You know, once the little king sets his army up on the upper world. Danny's written a terrific closing piece.
What kind of timeline are we talking about with this one? I mean, it sounds like it's going to be one hell of a production.
Well, it's funny. I've got people ready to finance it, and I have this thing called Buzzing. I don't know if you've seen it, like on buzzing.com. We're building kind of a more than a website, but a production entity, like a mini network. And I'm just wrapping up the final deals with that. And then at that point, I'm going to put all my attention on Forbidden Zone 2. But check out buzzing.com. All we want is worldwide media domination.
Big going to Paul. fine, but for mine I want to feel. I've been settled down in my La Pico and the Quadra, Pico and the Quadra, Pico and the Quadra.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The Smooth Sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
And we're back. Let's talk a little bit more about the movie. The Forbidden Zone still plays theatrically from time to time, and if memory serves, we have Mr. Sizek to thank for that.
Oh, I don't want to take all the credit.
Well, go ahead. Go ahead.
I can tell my story, which is it's similar to my Crime Wave story. In the late 90s, the Maryland Film Festival had asked me to pick a movie to bring to the festival that I liked and didn't think audiences had seen yet. And I'd already picked Crime Wave, so I picked Forbidden Zone the second year. And I tracked down Richard Elfman, and I kind of got the feeling that, you know, there hadn't been any action with that film in a long time. And nobody had really approached him about it. And I said, well, you know, we really want to bring you in. We want to show this film. Well, the problem was he didn't have a 35 millimeter print and didn't even know where to find one. So it was looking like the screening wasn't going to happen. But he searched around and he found somewhere a pristine print. And he came to the Maryland Film Festival and he showed it. And as I'm watching the print, I'm like, wait a minute, there's a bunch of scenes here I've never seen before. And I pointed them out to him and he didn't even notice it. But here was a pristine 35 millimeter print with additional scenes. And as soon as that screening happened, I noticed that the film started popping up, being screened elsewhere. In fact, it even came back to Baltimore for a theatrical run. And then the DVD came out. So who knows if I hadn't caught him? Yeah, I don't. Yeah.
Now, the DVD that came out, was that the black and white version or was that the colorized version?
That was the black and white.
Now, this is the only film that I actually own both the black and white and the colorized version of, because I actually kind of like the colorized version. I don't know what you guys think.
I love the color. I don't watch black and white one.
It looks cool.
Yeah.
It's funny. I always thought, even though I know the movie's black and white, when I'm not watching it and I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking the color. You know, I'm seeing the colors from the album cover, you know, in my head. So it's like, to me, the movie was in color anyway. So to finally actually see it with the color and not have to imagine it was actually kind of a cool thing.
Wasn't Hervé a little bit of an alcoholic as well?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes. He loved his lewds. He loved Dunkin' Donuts, too.
Okay, I wasn't sure if I was remembering that correctly or if that was just like a scene from like Hot Tomorrows or something where he's in the bar drinking and stuff. So, and then that movie was like lost for a lot of years, but that one's finally, I mean, it's not available legitimately on VHS or DVD, but if you look around, you can find it. It's it was a student film, if memory serves. But yeah, it's interesting. It's a nice, you know, footnote to Forbidden Zone, as well as Oingo Boingo's appearance on The Gong Show. That's always a fun thing to see as well, which is weird because even though Danny Elfman is there, he's not like front and center the whole time.
Richard kind of made it sound like Mystic Knights of Oingo Boingo was his thing. And then, you know, I guess as they got older and started branching out more, Danny took it over more, and then it became Oingo Boingo, and of course he was the front man for Oingo Boingo.
That was always my understanding of it too, that Elfman was Richard Elfman was the guy who was, you know, the head of Oingo Boingo originally, and he expressed interest in getting into film, branching out, and so that's why he kind of stretched out from it.
Hopefully everybody that's listening realizes that Danny Elfman then, after Oingo Boingo, and Oingo Boingo showed up in other movies too. I mean, let's not forget their incredible turn in Back to School. I mean,
Weird Science.
It was great to see him in that. And then Danny Elfman went into soundtrack music and he did a lot of great soundtracks. And then he just started doing the same soundtrack over and over and over again, just with like slightly different variations. So it's like, you know, now anytime you hear like these ethereal choral voices going on, you pretty much know like, oh, this is a Danny Elfman soundtrack because this sounds exactly like all of his other ones. So
every time you hear the Edward Scissorhands soundtrack in a car commercial, you know that Danny's getting a check.
I was just going to say that's what happens when you're married to Bridget Fonda. You lose all creative integrity.
All creative integrity, and you just decide to do the same song over and over again. Yeah, it's like I wish that the soundtrack for Spider-Man was something to actually remember, but you hear it, and then you leave the theater, and you're like, yeah, there was music in there. I don't remember what it was, but it was definitely Danny Elfman.
Well, he's done some good scores. You know, I'm a huge fan of his Batman score.
Batman was great, yeah.
I love the theme he did for Army Darkness.
Yeah, you know? That was good. Simpsons was amazing. I even like the soundtrack for Midnight Run. I really like that one. Yeah, you know, he was doing like Pee-wee's Big Adventure is one of the best soundtracks ever, you know. But yeah,
I think that was his first, too.
Yeah, yeah. And then after a while, though, it was just like, I don't know, it was like, as Tim Burton ran out of steam, so did Danny Elfman. And then Elfman kind of started doing other stuff, and it all just kind of sounded like Tim Burton soundtrack music. I don't know. I'm not here to bash on Danny Elfman, but I will, because I think it needs to be said. He needs to be called out about that. Yeah, I love the soundtrack for this one. Soundtrack's available on CD. Unfortunately, when it was released on CD, they couldn't get rights for a couple songs. So a couple of the songs of the movie are not available on the CD, including Pico and Sepulveda, one of my favorites. And then I always forget that the soundtrack of the movie is slightly different than the soundtrack, either album or CD, which so it might even be better just to tape the darn tape it. Yeah, it'll be better to hold up your cassette player and record it right off of the little one speaker of your TV.
That would have worked in 84.
Yeah, that would have been great. And then you can drive around with your car stereo listening to your cassette tape of the soundtrack. That will make you very happy. We were talking about The American Astronaut being somewhat similar. Are there any other movies that you guys can think of that are anywhere near either the artistic level or the weirdness level of The Forbidden Zone?
There's one that I can think of that failed miserably, and it fails on every level, and that's Nick Zedd's Geek Maggot Bingo, which is a feature length, Zedd's first feature length. You know, it's got the same mentality, but it just doesn't work. You know, it's super low budget. It's very similar that, you know, the sets are painted on the walls, and, you know, it's just kind of oddball and really out there. It just doesn't work, but it does remind me when I watch Forbidden Zone, I do think about Geek Maggot Bingo.
I'm sorry that you ever have to think about that movie or about Nick Zedd.
I would put Highway to Heartache and Lick of Fury, and I know it's animated, but Quasi at the Quacadero up there as reminding me of Forbidden Zone.
I can definitely see Quasi. You know, I haven't seen Lick of Fury. Maybe I saw it at your place one time. So let's go ahead. We're going to take a break. And when we're back, well, I won't tell you what happens when we're back.
You are about to be married. You have 48 hours to have the time of your life. What do you do?
Guess that means we just have to go to Myrtle Beach.
Oh, I'm not good.
Well, what are you doing?
Turn on the radio. Woo!
Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more. Come out of here on the floor. Honey, let's rock.
A time of Elvis, Fabian, petal scarves, angel flips, itsy bitsy bikinis, sweet potatoes, and purple Jesus. Proper Southern girls weren't twisting it. They were shaking it to The Shack. This is the story of four faithful friends. A senator's daughter.
I don't want anybody sitting on the furniture.
Don't anybody use the telephone. Daddy's bourbon is strictly off limits.
A preacher's innocent child.
Where have I seen you before?
Maybe in one of your better dreams.
A baby fat blossom.
Please, God, somebody asked me to dance.
A reluctant bride-to-be.
I'm sorry, I'm engaged.
And the one weekend.
I don't think I'm doing the right thing. There's always divorce.
They went absolutely.
Get your eyes full.
Unbelievably.
I got news. You're gonna lose.
Uncontrollably.
Now, we can have a good time. But we cannot be wild.
Wild.
I hope you know nothing is going to happen between us.
They went all the way.
Y'all is the horniest bunch of whack folks I ever seen.
Bridget Fonda. Annabeth Gish. Paige Hanna. Phoebe Cates. Tyrone Power Jr.
Did y'all let Carson get intoxicated?
Ow! This boy is crazy.
Kerry Hamilton. Robert Rustler. And the shagging of Dirty Dancing choreographer Kenny Ortega.
Oh, this is the most fun.
I'm having the most fun.
Oh, what the hell?
Just when you thought life was a drag, along comes Shag.
All right, we're back. That was audio from next week's feature, which is Shag, which is not to be confused with Shaq. Every time I see it, I think that Justin is doing a Shaquille O'Neal film, which hopefully one of these days will do Steel or some of his other work. But
what about Kazam?
Kazam would be good. Or we will just talk about his history as a rapper, because I'm a big fan of Shaq Diesel.
Yeah, there you go. All right. I like that.
Thanks for listening to another fabulous episode of The Projection Booth. Big thanks, too, to our special guest commentator this week, Skiz Sizek. To keep up on Skiz, visit his website at skiz.net. That's SKIZZ.net. Be sure to check us out on iTunes or via this here newfangled smartphone app, Stitcher. Download that app via the Android or iTunes store. Or hey, just go ahead and listen to us via our website, projection-booth.com.
Just dying to stick his fork in that dear tomato.
Is your boss the leader of the sixth dimension?
No, that'd be the little midget king.
humanity is the same.
Investing there is pleasure. As dead rats, we're free to bleed, to rot, and at our leisure, be eaten up by worms.
No, 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 no.
It's hunting here forever.
Forever?
If you think you're really very clever, just eat more cakes and pies.
La, 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 la.
Billy, what's the hurry? Oh, Billy, so maybe you've got a couple little pebbles. Just tell them all to me.
Well, I'll get them together.
So my friends had some advice to you and then this drama may be over, but it really not the end.
Always talk to the land of the adventure.